Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Coin Geek Weekly live stream. I am your increasingly blue host, Kurt Wooker Jr. I'm not sure why the lighting has made me look that much more purple. I promise you, I'm actually quite warm compared to the rest of the episodes that you've seen previously, as Chicago has had record freezing temperatures. In fact, I have cracks all over the plaster and the drywall in my home due to it being negative 20 outside and balmier inside. So, not sure what the lighting's all about, but we're going to get it fixed in due time, just probably not on this cast. So I want to thank everybody for coming. We do these every Tuesday afternoon at 1 o'clock Central Standard Time, where you can bring your questions, comments, blessings, cursings, grapes, gripes, or gropes, and we will answer them live from the troll box. Sometimes we have guests and sometimes we do not. This week, we will be joined by the prolific Ryan X. Charles to talk about a number of different things, but before we do that, I want to thank our sponsors. First, FreeBSV.com and Zatoshi on Twitter, who has been kind enough to donate one whole BSV for us to give away on this show across five opportunities. So be ready with your Simply Cash and Relay X wallets. When they pop up, people sweep them very, very quickly because there's a number of people out there rocking and rolling. I got Thrills saying, nice echo. Am I echoing? Is my audio bad? How do I sound? I got my lovely producer in the background looking at me grimacingly. Let's see if I can bring the microphone a little closer here. A little better? Is it better if I talk directly into the microphone? All right, cool. We'll eliminate a little bit of the echo there. The show is live, and as such, we have some of the issues that live broadcasts have. So thank you, Trollbox, for being my guest sound engineer. So we're going to cover a couple of interesting things. Oh, rest of the sponsors. My bad. This is the worst part. My goal is to have so many sponsors that the only thing in the camera is my face, but everything else is just logos that are paying all of us streaming because, well, Bitcoin's awesome like that. So FreeBSV, buybsv.com, CoinGeek, obviously, and a number of other people. But if you're interested in being featured as one of the sponsors on the show, please reach out to my delightful executive producer, Alex Moon, the creator of Mooncoin, coming soon. So let's talk a little bit about Bitcoin and Ethereum and some of the major differences. We're going to bring Ryan in. Ryan has more experience than most in the BSV economy, but coming from working on all kinds of previous Bitcoin projects and being quite aware of what's going on as he is a Silicon Valley guy, which is where there's just a whole lot of development going on. So Bitcoin uses the UTXO model, which is I'm not even going to go into it. As compared to Ethereum, which uses the account-based model to create a state machine. And Ryan will be so kind to bring us into that conversation. And let's start with a quick ad from our lovely sponsor, and we will come back with Ryan X. Charles. Please have your questions ready, and we're going to fire away. So, Alex, to the end.
This is buybsv.com, the quick and simple way to buy Bitcoin SV. You can't miss it. It says a quick and simple way to buy BSV on buybsv.com. It's safe and secure. Within an hour, you'll own BSV digital assets, which means it's so quick and simple. So if you want to buy BSV, use buybsv.com. It does exactly what it says.
Hey, Ryan. How you doing, sir? It's really good to have you on the live stream. Thanks for making the time.
Very good. Good to see you, Kurt. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So I started and then decided I won't kill it by giving anybody what the story is between UTXO versus the state model. Do you want to give a brief? I mean, is that something that can happen in like 30 to 90 seconds, or do we need to like bust out the whiteboard and...
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, I can do a 30 to 90 second one, and then we can try to expand if people want to go into it. Perfect. More. So first of all, let's talk about Bitcoin first. So Bitcoin is peer-to-peer electronic cash. What this means is, Kurt, if I'm paying you, I create a transaction and I give it to you. At least that's what it's supposed to mean. Bitcoin wallets haven't really worked that way for the most part since the original Bitcoin wallet software and the original node software. The original software was monolithic, and that it was a mining software and a wallet all rolled into one. And it had the idea of pay to IP address. For various reasons, this was dropped from the entire ecosystem for a really, really long time until fairly recently when MoneyButton and Handcash had peer-to-peer transactions going. So we, in early I guess it was early last year. It's probably a little more than a year ago now. We added the ability for money button, hand cash, money button to pay each other by giving a transaction to the recipient, which is the whole idea of how this is supposed to work. Now, inside of a Bitcoin transaction, you have multiple inputs and multiple outputs. What that means is basically you have to spend the money that you have. So if I give you money, Kurt, I must have a what's called a UTXO somewhere that is an output inside of an earlier transaction. And I spend it by creating a new transaction with an input that links to the earlier output. So I can spend one input or I can spend as many as I want to in a single transaction. The outputs then are, I can have as many outputs as I want to. So normally I would pay you and then I would send some back to myself as change, but I could pay 10 different people at the same time if I wanted to for whatever reason. So Bitcoin transactions have multiple inputs and multiple outputs. Now, it doesn't have state really, because the only sense of state, so state would be like the status of something. So like, what is the state of the weather? It would be like the temperature. Or what is the state of the location of a box? It would be like the location is the state. The dimensions could be a part of the state. So state is an arbitrary way to represent essentially data that defines a system or something like this. But in any case, the state doesn't, there's no global state or something like this, at least not with respect to Bitcoin transactions. The only input of data is actually in the input to each transaction. So when I create a transaction, I give it to you. There are two things that I'm inputting. I'm inputting a UTXO. So in other words, I link to it. I have transaction ID, the output number there, but I also put data in there. And so if I'm spending a normal output that I have, I put in there a signature and a public key. That is the data that I'm inserting. So it's not just money that I'm inputting data as well. And in this case, we can call this the state. The state that I'm inputting is PubKey signature. You can put other things in there. So I can, we'll talk about this in a moment, I think, because we got connected because of this whole XOR idea that, Craig gave me, and I created a little proof of concept of what the hell he was talking about. Absolutely. But anyway, the point is that a Bitcoin transaction has inputs and outputs, and the outputs are scripts. They're called UTXOs. We often call this the UTXO model. What it doesn't have is a notion of global state. So inside of a transaction, I can't just call some data. I can't say, for instance, just query from Bitcoin, what is the weather? What is the location of a box or something like this? The only way I get the weather and the only way I get the location of a box is to input that in each transaction. So I must input the data in the input. So there's no global state. It's always local. And so this is reminiscent of things like functional programming where there are no side effects. For people familiar with that, in functional programming, the whole idea is you have like functions calling functions, et cetera. You're passing around the data and it sort of goes through and there's no such notion, or you try to stay away from the notion of global state. So I don't know what the weather is unless you tell me inside of the transaction is kind of where I'm getting right. This. That is the fundamental difference. I should say what's a fundamental difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum. It's also the flaw in Ethereum. You have a question. I'm probably way over 90 seconds here.
It's interesting to me, but I'm curious, like, to break it down to somebody that may not understand, like, why would somebody look at Ethereum and say, oh, this looks great, I want to develop here? Is it that the tooling is better, or is there something about the state model in Ethereum that attracts development?
Well, I think there are many reasons. It's the two things you said, though. So first of all, it does what it says in that there is state and you can reference that state. This makes certain things easier. Programming on Bitcoin is harder. So that's an important difference. It's just easier in principle to understand what's going on in Ethereum if you're kind of get going. That's a good reason to prefer Ethereum. I believe the tooling is also far better. So Ethereum and the Ethereum ecosystem, they have spent a lot of time developing good tooling. So that's another really important part of the reason there. A third part, unfortunately, is that there's also a lot of misinformation about Bitcoin and a lot of malicious actors that have tried to prevent Bitcoin from working. So going back to the early days, first of all, very, very few people, if any, aside from Craig, understood what the hell Bitcoin is supposed to be. And you can see if you watch the interview series I'm doing with Craig, I'm 10 years into it now. I'm still learning some basic things. Okay. There's a lot to Bitcoin. Yeah. And, you know, he has been trying to explain this stuff to people. He's good at a lot of things, but I think when it comes to explaining what Bitcoin is, clearly hasn't actually worked. Like we still have to struggle to explain Bitcoin to people. So that's part of it. But there are reasons why Bitcoin works the way it does. So it's harder. The tooling is worse. We can improve the tooling. We'll never change the fundamentals. But the reason why the fundamentals are what they are is because it scales. It's fundamentally a scalable, secure model. Ethereum doesn't scale. It's really very simple. Like because of the global state idea, because they didn't do the UTXO-based approach, you arrive at the following problem. In Bitcoin, it is possible to validate as many transactions as you want to in parallel. So let's suppose you have, you know, miners are validating transactions. The bigger the network gets, the more transactions you have. It's really important to be able to distribute that load across as many computers as you need to process that volume. In Ethereum, there's a fundamental flaw introduced from the idea of global state. The fundamental flaw is that the order in which you validate transactions matters. There's no way to know what a script does in Ethereum until you run it, because it can modify global state. And if you do things in a different order, so let's suppose, for instance, I pay you conditionally upon some other fact. And that fact happens depending on the order of another transaction. It could happen before or it happens after. So for instance, I'm being paid by my employer. I pay you if I've been paid first. And if I haven't been paid, I don't pay you. The order of transactions matters in Ethereum.
Sure.
So what that means is the miners have to validate all of them in the same order as everyone else, which means you can't parallelize it. I can't just throw a million transactions at you and then you add a million computers. Right. You're reduced to having a single computer that validates them one after the other. It's like practically impossible to parallelize unless they pivot it and switch everything around to work more like Bitcoin does. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say it's impossible, because in Ethereum, yeah, just to finish the thought, they have changed the rules in Ethereum. So perhaps they could change the rules to make it work more like Bitcoin, but that's what they would have to do to make it scale.
Well, and that's actually what I was going to say, is that, you know, Ethereum is basically whatever Vitalik says Ethereum is. So I think that's a lot what the change of proof of stake and then sharding. I mean, sharding is a type of parallelization. It's not exactly parallelizing transactions, but it's parallelizing various functions of state, as I understand it.
Well, what they're doing is it completely, to shard Ethereum the way that they talk about it, is to recreate the cryptocurrency industry where everybody essentially has their own coin. You create, instead of actually making it scale, you just create many miniature Ethereums that are all lightly connected to one another, is kind of what it is when they say sharding. So it means you're locked into a little sub-Ethereum ecosystem. Well, you completely lose the benefits of having one global public blockchain if you don't really have one global public blockchain. You got a bunch of mini ones and everybody's on some mini one. In order to get from this one to this one, well, you can't just go from this one to this one. You got to create whatever transactions that move your money or something like this. And it's all of a sudden, if you're dealing with someone that isn't in your local area, it becomes more difficult. It's the very problem that Bitcoin solves. The whole point is to not have tons of these different protocols. So yeah, anyways, that's not really a solution, but that is the direction they're going in. But yeah, that won't work.
So we got KP Dad asking, if they did that now, would BSV still have a head start? Like if they were to change to proof of stake, like if Ethereum 2.0 was completely rolled out in the next 6 weeks, what would they look like as a competitor to BSV's model today?
I think it's utterly hopeless. I don't think Ethereum can realistically pivot. I could give you countless reasons, but this is part of where just being around for a while has been kind of interesting, because I go back to the early days here and I can watch how long it takes to do things and how long it takes people to understand stuff. Trying to fix Ethereum is highly non-trivial. Like this is like, they need a fundamental, and they're not even looking in the right area. Like they're not even trying to solve the problems that really need to be solved. At least last I checked, I don't stay up to speed on Ethereum on like a daily basis or something. I just try to see where they are, but you can see how slowly they're moving here. So to require such a radical refactor of what Ethereum is, I don't think that's actually realistic. I don't think there's anything they can ultimately do. So Ethereum is not as scammy as some of the other ones. There is like a larger fraction of legitimate people involved in Ethereum than involved in some of the other ones. But they're too off the mark. I think it's unrealistic that they'll be able to pivot. I mean, so it doesn't really stand a chance. I think the only one that stands a chance is BSV. Of course, I'm speaking to the choir here, as most of the people watching this are probably BSV enthusiasts, but that's true.
So it's interesting. We got a question here from Arcade Rob saying, can we get input on how BSV scaling differs from Polkadot and Cardano sharding? They claim a million transactions a second. I've actually pretty recently looked into this myself, and the current implementations of Cardano and Polkadot are both at about 1,000 transactions a second. A lot of people don't know that Polkadot was actually created as a separate chain by accident. It was a smart contract on Ethereum that broke consensus somehow and they decided to spin it off into its own project and act like it was a good thing. However, I mean, same with Cardano. Not same with Cardano in that sense, but what Cardano and Polkadot both want to do is basically push things off chain. It's the Lightning Network model. Push things off chain, process them in a place that it just uses centralized database rules, and then push them back on chain where appropriate.
Okay.
Which I think is silly. So, I mean, if it's not on chain, it didn't happen. And if being on chain is what matters, then processing things on somebody's side pot is kind of a weird model. But
yep.
Can you perhaps explain the nature of a virtual machine on BSV, for example? Bitcoin Computer, Run, and some of these other models have their own VM. Is that VM off-chain, or how, maybe for the people that don't understand, what is the difference between a sort of token protocol on BSV versus something like Ethereum?
Well, there are many reasons. I mean, first of all, Run and Bitcoin Computer are very different. So they are JavaScript virtual machines. I mean, the whole idea of what they're doing is they're kind of putting their little state into a transaction, but then most of the computation actually occurs off-chain. That's a way to do it. But they're not really using the full flexibility of Bitcoin. So you can see in the interview series I'm doing with Craig, we're starting to get into these really, detailed, covering in detail how to really do this on Bitcoin for real. The way you should really do it is you shouldn't be using JavaScript. I mean, you could, but you should compile down to script, actually. Script is more like the operations that go inside of a computer. And again, this is just relevant because this is what we were just talking about in the interview series, but how do you define functions, for example? Well, there's no such thing as a function built into Bitcoin script, but you can define that at the layer above. And there are many different ways you can do this. You can define it as a chunk of code. You can define it as a reference to a UTXO. You could define it as a reference to a UTXO in a different transaction or in the current transaction. You could do it referencing parts inside other scripts and things like this. There are a number of different ways to define functions, but that occurs at the layer above. The point is that if you do it in script and you do it using Bitcoin primitives, such as different sighash types and opcode separator and these things, what you can do is you can negotiate transaction DAGs. It's a DAG just means essentially like directed acyclic graph means like a tree of transactions. And the point of saying that is more like instead of negotiating one transaction, you can negotiate as many as you want to for whatever reason. So I call that the transaction DAG. That's just what's in Bitcoin is a transaction DAG. You can negotiate this with multiple people. So anyway, if you do this with the Bitcoin primitives, you produce valid transactions and then you can settle on chain. So if you do it that way, you do like payment channels and you do putting keys, sharing keys, whatever, however, which way you do it like this, it's more automatically compatible with what miners are doing. And people can do far more than what I think most people have experimented with. I mean, most of script was actually disabled until Genesis, which was only like a little more than a year ago now. It's unbelievable, but the Bitcoin was completely throttled. And so a lot of people's understanding of Bitcoin was based on the era before that, which was most of the history of Bitcoin, which was where script wasn't even enabled. So anyone that wanted to do anything real couldn't do it until Genesis. And I don't think people have really wrapped their minds around the possibilities that are now staring us in the face here. We can do script for real. So you don't need to run JavaScript off-chain. You can. There are reasons to do it that way. But you can also use script for real. And the advantage of this is, well, you can always settle to that which is enforced by miners. And only if you do it that way do you get certain constraints. You can do all the ideas Craig likes to talk about, like accessing systems and things like this. You can use Bitcoin and settle on chain and leverage the Bitcoin network. But the more you differ from that, if you use JavaScript, you end up having to rebuild a lot of infrastructure. And the whole JavaScript approach has a scalability problem because what they don't have a lot of the ideas that, again, Craig and I were talking about the interview series just recently, but the whole mathematical induction idea. This is the idea where you don't want to have to revalidate the whole history of transactions. In the JavaScript-based approach, it's really hard to avoid that. They end up having these computers that run the state and have to maintain state separately. It's sort of, they end up in a semi-centralized approach because they don't have all these answers.
Well, if you real quick, I think they would have a back to Genesis problem that would be similar to like BTC scaling, wouldn't they? If it's running in a VM, then every time you move the token, it becomes that much more complicated to prove that it was moved, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you end up, the more you move a token around, you end up with a history there. And so to validate the new state, you have to validate everything. And I actually, I'm not up to speed on their projects. As far as I'm aware, I had not seen a solution to that particular problem from either of them, from either Bitcoin Computer or from Run. Again, I'm not trying to, it's just like, that's just how it is. And if you use script and you build everything kind of in a primitives first approach, you can avoid these problems. The problem with doing it in script is that it's a problem I said earlier, which is it's kind of hard. You know, compared to just writing a contract in Ethereum, it's very conceptually easy to understand. In script, in order to work around these scalability issues with Bitcoin, work around the sense that it's designed to be scalable, but it constrains how you can solve problems because it kind of forces you to continue to do it in the scalable way. So you have to use these unusual techniques that you're not used to using if you're developers are not used to using these techniques. Like it's just different. Right. Than what you're used to doing. But if you do it that way, it does scale. So anyway, that's a difference there. You referenced these other projects like Cardano, and I forget the other one, but I can't comment on those. Yeah. I haven't studied those specifically, but a way to look at it on Bitcoin is it's really funny how these people have the scalability problems because they don't seem to understand, they still don't understand Bitcoin. They're still proud about their 1,000 or million transactions per second. There is no scale ceiling on Bitcoin. When you understand that it can be parallelized, it's just like any other infrastructure problem. There is no scale ceiling. It's a matter of you can write up more optimized software and things like this, but there is no theoretical problem. It's going to be a matter just like the internet, having custom hardware, custom software that scales it, but there's no problem. There's no theoretical problem. On Ethereum, they have a theoretical problem. They don't even know how to scale it. It's like, well, we figured out how to get up to such and such transaction. In Bitcoin, it's a theoretically solved problem. We know how to do it. You are going to need to write more software. You are going to need to build more hardware, deploy more hardware. But it's all very straightforward computer science stuff that isn't different than how you scale the internet. It's exactly the same problem, fundamentally. Right.
Well, and it's interesting because looking back, you know, I have these conversations all the time because I'm basically live on social media. But people say like, wow, Satoshi, you know, didn't understand that, you know, pooled hash would be a thing or that, you know, and you can find quotes from before the Genesis block was even mined of him saying, you know, we'll move up to industrialized farms and pooled mining and they'll all connect to one LAN and all, you know, it's like, so Satoshi very clearly realized that there was going to be scaling issues, but not with the protocol, but that the issues would be in hardware, software, implementation and everything else. And, I find it so humorous that Satoshi has been written so out of the history of these things and that people don't want to look back and say, well, what did Satoshi say about the nature of this problem? What is the scaling ceiling? And he specifically said that there is no scaling ceiling in his famous quote about scaling to Visa level payments and stuff. Yes. So yeah, it is fascinating. Well,
these are you have a combination of ignorant people and malicious people that are spooling up all this crap. It doesn't take that long to go back in and read Satoshi, but only you and only those of us in the BSV community remind people, have you actually read what Satoshi wrote? Did you even read the white paper? Like the Square people that are hosting the white paper. Like, I don't think they understood the white paper that they're standing behind. You know, like what they're doing is so in opposition to what the white paper says. I don't think they understand the white paper. I don't think they read Satoshi. If they did, they read it through a lens where they're trying to find what they want in it. So the ignorant people, they're people that don't even realize that they don't know stuff. There's a lot of those people. They just don't read Satoshi or who knows what. But then you have some people that are trying to spin it. And I watched all this stuff unfold. You had people go back in and select choice quotes from Satoshi to spin their narrative. They weren't trying to understand. They were willfully malicious. And unfortunately, those people have been very influential. So a lot of this blocks understanding because most people do not even realize how much stuff that there is that they don't understand. Or they don't even know what Bitcoin even is. Like for instance, the major one is it's really important to look at Bitcoin as an economic system more than anything else. It's not like it's just some C++ code. That's a silly way to look at it. It's an economic system. And if you don't look at it through the lens of economics, it wouldn't make any sense. Or you get these peculiar ideas that come out of the cypherpunks in the cryptocurrency world that are just off the mark because they don't understand any of this stuff. But anyway, I'll stop there. The point is that, yeah, just read Satoshi. For the people watching this, if you haven't read Satoshi, you can look up the writings of Satoshi Nakamoto, obviously the white paper itself, and the cryptography mailing list, and the original Bitcoin forum. It was not hosted at BitcoinTalk.org originally. It was originally at Bitcoin.org, or I think it might have been SourceForge originally. It was moved to Bitcoin.org. In any case, there are original writings from Satoshi. You can read all of it in a day. It's like shorter than a book, but it's extremely explanatory. And you'll see, if you just read it with an open mind, just read what he said, it's like, gosh, that's incredibly different from the way that people pitch Bitcoin today. It's polar opposite.
Well, and what's fascinating about it is that it solves almost every debate that I think we've had over the last 12 years. I have yet to have a debate with somebody that I cannot go back and very quickly reference Satoshi and say, here's the solution to that problem. Like you've come up with a question that was actually already answered and you didn't care to look. So, I mean, we have a major PR problem, but like you said, I think it is a mix of ignorance and malice. So,
yeah.
Frankly, it's our job, if we care about Bitcoin or care about the idea of Bitcoin, even to go back and look. I think a lot of people that are in the ignorant camp could very quickly become allies if they were to see what Satoshi actually said about these things. And that's my real goal, frankly, is I want to work with more people. I want to see more people say, hey, you know what? My Ethereum idea doesn't work. Where can I get 50,000 transactions a second? Because that's what I need for my business model. And is there anybody, I mean, I don't know the limitations right now on a lot of these token protocols. I've looked into Escrypt and Stas tokens and some of these other things too. Do you know anywhere near like what the scale limitations are on some of these things?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's really finished the way the tokens should work on BSV yet. So I'm not sure there's going to be simply a single protocol or something that people use for tokens under the hood. My position is there are different reasons to have different protocols, and it can be more or less off-chain depending on what you're doing. So as far as what the scalability, it's unfortunately we're pretty premature is a way to look at it. Like a lot of that stuff hasn't really happened. You can't just create it. We don't have a plug and play replacement for Ethereum, for example.
Right.
So somebody could go out and try to create a plug and play replacement for Ethereum. But I'm worried that if you did that, you're just going to reintroduce the very scalability problems that Ethereum has. You could do it on Bitcoin. But if you add back in notions like global state, you're going to have the same scalability problems Ethereum has. So I think the real way to do it is just very different from Ethereum. So I want to suggest a totally different alternative. Forget about the cryptocurrency industry completely. This is not even a real market. It's a massive bubble. Okay. The amount of scams and crime and stuff like this under the hood is, I think people, almost everyone underestimates how crap the cryptocurrency industry is. It is mostly a giant scam. I created two videos about this recently. I could go into this in detail, but it's mostly a giant scam. I think when you look at coinmarketcap.com, look at the numbers. It's about 99.9% scam. Okay, like most of these things are just jokes. They're pitching themselves as being better than Bitcoin. Every single one of them regressed. They didn't even understand what Bitcoin was. They don't even understand the way in which they regressed on the original Bitcoin. Mostly a scam. What will happen? So in terms of like concentrating on a market, pick real markets. Ignore crypto. So if you want to make a token, who is your customer? Well, an example of like a real customer would be the Federal Reserve. That should be your goal. How do you service the Federal Reserve? How do you create a token on BSV that the Federal Reserve, our friend and customer, can actually issue the actual US dollar on BSV?
Right.
That's how we should be thinking. And this isn't that, oh, we're going to take down the Fed or something silly like this. No. You're just going to lose if you look at it like that. They're the biggest possible customer we could possibly have. Someone should create a protocol that can service the Federal Reserve. That token protocol, to my knowledge, doesn't currently exist. The way to get from here to there is you can start with small countries, start with small banks, find small use cases, start with things like, you know, utility points, these types of things, things where you can work with a small business that wants to try something new and create a niche product. But along the way, you design and develop these protocols that are going to be used for real by Wall Street, by London, you know, whatever.
Well, sure.
Stock exchanges of the world, and ultimately the Federal Reserve, and put the US dollar on Bitcoin. So we're not there yet, but that will take, you know, you can work your way there. Start with real customers. Forget about crypto. The cryptocurrency industry is going to go bust. I'll just say this very briefly. If I'm right, well, just think about it. It's going to completely go to zero. So what will happen to the entire cryptocurrency industry, and for people that aren't clear, I am excluding Bitcoin from that, because anybody's heard what Craig has been saying and myself echoing him, is that Bitcoin is not a cryptocurrency. Crypto means secret writing. Currency means money used by government. Bitcoin is not either of those things. It's not secret writing. It's completely transparent and public on the blockchain. And it's not currency because it's not being used that way by governments. Right. It's not a cryptocurrency. The cryptocurrency industry is a massive scam, and it's going to go bust. Just forget about those people. Find real customers that are real businesses, real financial services companies, and governments, and solve their problem. And this can be done, but no, we don't have those protocols yet. That will take years to develop this to a level of maturity that the Federal Reserve can actually use. But that is a real possibility, and that's how to think about this.
Absolutely. Well, and it's funny, to the people that talk about it like, well, you know, they're the enemy, Bitcoin was supposed to replace all these things. I actually think it's it's fascinating that there's it's like a 1 + 2 = 5 situation. And it's like, well, you're missing a step in there, right? And I think the big step is, well, how does Bitcoin replace government? I mean, practically, you know, what do those steps look like? And that's obviously never discussed because it has to be
.. And then it replaces government. See, can't you just right. see this stuff happens in the middle there and then there you go.
For sure. Well, and I think like what you're saying is exactly that. I mean, if you start with a business plan and then you show people, oh, wow, there's extra efficiency, there's extra transparency, and all of a sudden it becomes less and less practical to commit fraud. And then all of a sudden, over that generation that Bitcoin replaces these things slowly, all of a sudden people don't have such a problem with their government because their government isn't able to commit fraud in the ways that people complain about. And then, I mean, we've made the system better anyways. So I think people need to start thinking like that, you know, baby steps, practical problem solving, and stop trying to use Bitcoin as a political tool fundamentally. I think it can be a part of a great many political things, but yes. It in and of itself, yeah, should obviously be apolitical. So that's a really good point, Ryan. I appreciate it. I'd like to bang out a couple of these questions because I'm actually shocked. We're getting piles and piles of questions here. So Alan, real quick, saying, does it take less computational power per transaction mining a bigger block?
No. Why would that take? I mean, it takes the the processing power of a transaction is mostly dependent on check sig and check multisig. Okay, mm-hmm. Because those are the slowest operations. Even hashing a transaction to validate the hashes is nothing. It's check sig and check multisig. So it mostly scales according to how many of those operations you have inside the transaction. So normally what that means is it's essentially a function of the number of inputs because each input has a signature typically. I mean, we can start doing more advanced stuff, but typically they have like a signature and a public key in there and the check sig is run once. So essentially the slowness is determined by the number of inputs. But this is, as I was saying before, incredibly parallelizable. Each one of those inputs can in principle be validated in parallel. Meaning there is no actual bottleneck. Yes, it costs money for the miners to do that. And the more transaction volume, the more money it's going to cost. But there are businesses that earn money, small amounts for each transaction. So long as the fees per transaction are more than the cost, there's no actual problem there. It scales just fine.
Sure. You know, it occurred to me when you were talking about script, is there a place for GPU acceleration? Like if miners were to have a subset of their power moving to GPU acceleration to speed up some of the, you know, non-Bitcoin, non-SHA-256 functions, especially in virtual machine. Is anybody exploring GPU acceleration like that in Bitcoin?
I'm not aware of that for script validation, but I don't see why that wouldn't work. So you have enough power in those GPUs that you can do like highly serial types of computation in parallel. Serial in the sense that each pipeline is like a serial. So if you do something in an order, well, I don't see why checksig wouldn't satisfy that. So ECDSA, so you needed the ECDSA signature verification is a slow one. That is just some mathematical operations on big numbers, basically. It strikes me that almost, especially if they can do hashing with those things, they should be able to do ECDSA signature verification, meaning you know, what you could do is like each little pipeline in your GPU could just validate a signature. So you could throw it at a GPU, basically. Now, that requires writing that software. I don't know if anyone has done that, but yeah, you could do that. But that would be more like a, you know, you need to worry about things one step at a time because we're not facing that bottleneck right now. Doing transaction validation, we can go quite some ways before you need to worry about that. Like we've demonstrated, we as in the ecosystem, you know, mostly whoever it is doing this in-chain and whoever else have demonstrated gigabyte size blocks. I don't think they use GPUs to validate that. They just use a parallel, you know, multi-core computer, and that's good enough for now. So we got a lot of room to grow before we even have to worry about using GPUs to validate signatures.
Interesting. Yeah, just occurred to me that when you know talking about script, all of a sudden, I don't know how to read Cyrillic, so I'm not going to even attempt to butcher the name on this question. But this person is asking, what's the future for BSV in a total digital world? Will fast transactions win? I think that's pretty obvious. Yeah,
well,
I mean,
I'll tell you, this is again, like in the interview series with Craig is slowly explaining to me, I say slowly because it's taken me a while to understand here, but I'm gradually understanding his vision here. Essentially, the one future for BSV is essentially as a replacement for the TCP layer of the internet. So the protocol stack, the fundamental protocol stack is TCP IP. IP basically means you're at the address of your computer and protocols for like routing packets. TCP is a way to send large amounts of data. So it's a protocol that I can establish from my computer to yours to send you a stream of data. And that can be used inside of countless other things. So TCP is sort of under the hood of many internet protocols. So then we build on top of that, right? We use TCP for other things. You can actually replace the TCP layer with Bitcoin transactions. So instead of sending to, instead of a TCP packet or packets, I send you packets that, or even one packet, a jumbo frame as Craig references, to send an entire transaction in a single packet to your computer where the address is actually, the address in the Bitcoin transaction is the same as your IPv6 address. So you have IPv6 address, it's 128 bits. That can be like half of, say, a 256 bit key inside of a Bitcoin transaction. This allows you to do authentication and encryption. So you can do using authenticated encrypted communications that are Bitcoin transactions. When you have Bitcoin transactions going in that layer, you can imagine a different internet where everything is flexibly monetized as needed. So instead of ISPs establishing contracts with one another at a high level, I'll pay you such and such amount. Well, if all that were actually automatic because it were all just Bitcoin transactions, you're just paying stuff as you send it around. You don't even necessarily know who's doing what or whatever. People just build infrastructure and solve problems. And in that vision, Bitcoin ends up being underneath practically everything in the entire world economy, because when you got it going for the communication layer, you then build inside of this, finance and economics and like everything that you can imagine. You track stuff, the supply chain. So you buy and sell stuff. The communication layer you're using to communicate stuff is the same as the layers that you use to buy things and to create contracts with people and things like this. What would end up happening in that situation is you have tons of transactions that are not on chain yet. You negotiate them back and forth until they're finished. So you'd have ludicrously high transaction volume, most of which doesn't settle on chain. It would still be ludicrously high when it goes to the miners because you're going to be settling, but it's far more ludicrous off chain. So it'd be incredibly high. It's like all the communication you're doing on the internet would all be Bitcoin transactions. So that's, as I see it, that's kind of the end game here. That's the real vision. That's how we get 5 billion daily active users, because it ultimately replaces the TCP layer of the internet and everything on top of that, which is a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'm gonna rephrase this question a little bit from Mark Madrigal saying, how would smart contracts on BSV be different from smart contracts on Ethereum? I think the better question is what would be the practical way or the most practical way to get Ethereum developers to move to BSV or start there instead? Like if we were to just give like top three reasons why you should develop on BSV versus Ethereum. What do you think those would be, Ryan?
So the best way is to show them. So you need to create products and services that actually function. So show them. If you try to convince with a bullet point, 3 points or something like this, well, we've tried stuff like that. That hasn't been effective so far. I mean, I don't know how many more bullet lists we need to create and things like this. The most important thing is to create products and services that function. And so that means create something that's more popular than CryptoKitties, but that doesn't break when you get users. You will never need to make another argument ever again. As soon as somebody actually does that, everyone will see it and they'll be like, oh, they're real and everyone else isn't. So we need to take theory and make it reality. And so by showing them is definitely the best way. Everything else is less important, but there are other important things. So you can look at like how Ethereum got their ecosystem going. The fact that it's easy to use and they've got the tooling is really important. So it's going to be hard to get somebody. We can draw in more people making an attempt to make a successful product if the tooling and, the tooling needs to be a lot better. So it can be something that if you don't have the killer app in mind, then working on the tooling is a way to facilitate that.
Right. Is it fair to say that maybe BSV is a bad starting spot? Like people maybe need to fail once on Ethereum before they think to move to something like BSV.
The thing is, it's more subtle than that. Just because I don't think a lot of people on Ethereum know we exist or take us seriously. Like we have to go way out of our way to even show them it exists. Like when I talk with about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency with people, they've never even heard of BSV almost all the time. Like, they don't even know what it is, or they have some vague memory of it. They remember the hash battle between BCH and BSV or something like this. Right. But they don't really know very much about it. We have to fight this unusual battle of the disinformation and misinformation in the cryptocurrency world to get anything done. So we need to surmount that. Yeah, that's a whole other story. But
sure. So another question here from Arcade Rob. Not sure how to phrase this, but would it be possible to build similar, quote, heavy computing power required software to BSV like they're trying to do on Polkadot, Lightning? I think using BSV as a way to offload pressure from other networks. I actually joked about this, or I guess it was half joking, but Lightning is also has a this constant rotation of state as well. And that's why Lightning doesn't scale. But what I said is that somebody should start a business on BSV that writes the entire state of Lightning network to BSV every, you know, maybe every 30 seconds or something like that, and then sell that data back to Lightning Labs or whoever else. Do you think there's room for that? Maybe even in the just the midterm to make money using BSV as basically a distributed hard drive for some of these things?
Yeah, for I don't know about the, he said Polkadot or something. I don't know the details, so I can't comment on what that would take exactly. I would just come back to what I said before. I think if you're concentrating on cryptocurrency as an industry, you're missing the big picture. So forget about those people. Like the they're not even really. So many of these people are wrapped up in blatant scams, getting people. I mean, like, I can't even believe things like yield farming are like mainstream terms. Like these are massive, massive scams is what's really going on here. This is not an industry you want to touch. Get away from these people. Like they're, you know, like there's too many scammers. Now they're not all scammers. And there are some people just trying to build legitimate projects on there and so on.
Sure.
I would just say, you know, concentrate on creating real businesses, creating real value for real customers. I would say stay away from that by and large. With that being said, can you do something like put State of Lightning on there? Sure. That would be an interesting experiment. That would be a good thing for someone to do and kind of prove the concept of, well, we can do everything you're doing, but better and more and so on. So, yeah.
Right. Here's an interesting question. And so I did an interview about 3 weeks ago now on CJTV where I explained some of the connections of MasterCard and how MasterCard helped found some of these venture capital groups and other things explained. I think people took it as much more of a conspiracy video than I intended for it to be. But asking how much is true that Bilderberg, AXA, and MasterCard came in to allow BTC to fail as an electronic cash system? Do you think that it was purposeful? I actually think it's crystal clear that it was purposeful, because if I owned a big company, I would buy and patent stuff that was going to compete with me too. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just tell you, I want to start by referencing something because people have a misunderstanding about myself and my former company, Yours Inc. So first of all, we raised money from DCG in 2016. We raised $75,000 from DCG. DCG raised money from, I think it was AXA and or MasterCard or something like this. And then DCG, after we were acquired by Fabric, DCG put on their website that Money Button was acquired. And so people just invent stuff. They're like, oh, so Money Button was acquired and that's written on DCG's website. So I guess DCG owns Money Button now. What? No. We were acquired by Fabric. So the reason why DCG wrote acquired on their website is because we were acquired by somebody else. We're not owned by, I'm not even a part of it anymore. I resigned from Fabric. But in any case, you know, Money Button is now owned by Fabric. And they have nothing to do with DCG, as far as I'm aware. I mean, I'm pretty sure they have zero. Yeah. They're just gone now. The DCG got paid out. They got money and they have nothing to do with Money Button anymore. So anyway, on the rest of this, so there's a connection there, which is just DCG, but I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't have any inside information. So as far as what's going on, I can imagine all sorts of things going on behind the scenes. What they're probably thinking is, first of all, they do want to partially own what's going on. So they're like, we don't fully understand Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, but we have a lot of money and we have an interest in the area in which they're doing stuff. Why don't we invest in their company? And that way we partially own whatever it is that transpires. That's part of what's going on there. As far as whether there's any more malicious things, who knows? I have no idea. But I would just say, again, I look at this differently than most people. MasterCard is a prospective customer. Do not look at them as the enemy. If you look at people that are way, way, way bigger than you as the enemy, well, they're way bigger than you are. And if you just start fighting people that are way bigger than you are, you're just going to lose. Create products and services that MasterCard actually wants. They will buy it from you. Everybody wins. They end up using Bitcoin. You win because you have a successful business. They're a customer, not the enemy.
Yeah. And I think that's what I intended to express when I did that interview too, is that, you know, MasterCard is not a hive of villainy. They are a giant payments processor. Therefore, you know, Bitcoin is an existential threat to them if it's allowed to scale. So why not buy into it, research it. If they are, you know, if Bitcoin, the protocol, is the biggest competitor in the history of payments, well, then by all means, keep it small. Like, let's route some of those payments through MasterCard, and then we're all good there. But you mentioned Digital Currency Group and some of that. We have a, I think you got to kill the question first, Alex, and then we can put that Zatoshi wallet up there. So people get your Simply Cash wallets ready. This is your opportunity. So Digital Currency Group, venture capital, and some of this stuff. I would love to hear the story, because I don't know that you've told people publicly exactly what was what, but you announced your new business idea, and it was a day or two after mentioning that you're leaving Fabric and therefore Money Button and some of this stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about what was that journey from Money Button to Fabric to now Kozian? I'm sure that's a heck of a long story.
Yeah, well, I'll start with the Money Button part, because if I try to sell everything leading up to that part, we won't have time. So Money Button was, so first of all, there's a company called Yours Inc. That I co-founded with Clemens Lay. That company was formed in 2016. We created yours.org. Clemens resigned in 2018, and then we created Money Button. Money Button ended up becoming the primary product of Yours Inc. for a lot of reasons. I made the decision to sell Money Button to Fabric last year. Basically, there are a lot of issues. Like, we weren't really earning enough money as a company is really fundamentally the most important reason. We weren't a successful enough business. Mm-hmm. So I had to look around at what my options were. And fortunately, there was a company there. It's a very good, suitable acquiring company, which is then called the Bayesian Group, now called Fabric. So they were a very appropriate pairing for Money Button. So it was a way to essentially maintain and grow the product before we've nailed the business model for the company. So we sold paymails. We earned money from that, but we didn't earn enough money. So anyway, it's in their hands now. I've resigned. But the team has grown. So Money Button is, there's more people working on it now. They're taking customers more seriously. I never had enough time since we were such a small team to work with a lot of the customers. So there are a lot of issues that stayed unresolved. They can talk with the customers, work with people now. They're solving all those issues. So people should find that they actually have a better experience inside Fabric. So the team is bigger. They're very competent. They're building it and growing all that stuff. For a lot of reasons, I decided to resign. Fundamentally, my interests are a little bit, Fabric is concentrated mostly on tokens. So the vision for Fabric is something like, let's make sure the token ecosystem gets going on BSV and build around that. That's a very important mission. That's a very important idea for many reasons, including Money Button. Like, part of the idea is you should be able to send around fiat currency. You can manage all your financial assets and things like this. I have a lot of other particular interest, which anybody that watches the interview series with Craig will realize I'm very drawn to these more advanced ideas. So I'm drawn to things like, a market for computation on Bitcoin. I'm drawn to the idea of replacing the TCP layer of the internet with Bitcoin. And I'm drawn to the idea that when I look at in Silicon Valley, so I live in San Francisco, and I'm very deliberately immersed, I shouldn't say immersed in, let's just say next to the Silicon Valley ecosystem, that there's a lot of value we can create for all these people. And since this is my backyard, a very natural thing for me to do is concentrate on Silicon Valley as a market. Because when I look at all the major companies, small and big companies here, the same technology can create value for Google, Intel, right, Airbnb, go down Absolutely. The list, Silicon Valley companies, 90% the same software is going to create value for all of them. So Silicon Valley is a good market. So I'm just personally interested in that stuff. I also will say that inside Fabric, the team was very successful. So I had essentially offloaded all of my roles and responsibilities onto other people inside Fabric. So although I quit very suddenly, it only seemed sudden. Other people had taken over all these things. So I wasn't really needed anymore, if you understand what I'm saying. So I was like, okay, well, sure. I'm morally liberated from working on this stuff. Let me go do all these other things that I'm interested in that I can uniquely do. So Kosian's goal is to solve Silicon Valley's problem in the next 5 years. That's what I'm doing.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's funny. I've had a couple of conversations with people because I think people assume I'm some kind of PR contact for everything that happens. They're like, Kurt, what's going on with Ryan? And I was like, I don't really talk to Ryan that much. So, that's impossible. You're with CoinGeek. And I'm like, well, believe it or not, but among them, we've had a lot of people saying like, man, is Ryan just going to focus like full time on doing documentary work with Craig? Or, I've told everybody, like, first of all, that probably only takes him 2 hours a week or whatever. But second of all, Ryan Ryan has come up with a lot of ideas that have changed really the face of Bitcoin, frankly. So I don't suspect he's run out of ideas and just wants to be, you know, Craig's journalist at this point.
Yeah, I'll speak to that slightly because just so that it's clear. Yeah, I'm not going to work on that project full time. That's definitely part time for Craig and I. I do look to myself as Craig's student, as I say in every one of these episodes of these things. And you can see it's clear to me. I hope it's clear to the audience. I am genuinely learning. So the goal is I want to make sure I understand Craig's vision, as he always says. You know, it's more like the programming language C. He hasn't envisioned every program you can write in it, but he's envisioned this tool that can be used. So I want to just understand the tool completely. And if I'm 10 years in and I don't fully understand, well, that ought to be an important priority of mine. I need to make sure I understand, communicate this to other people, not everyone, but in interested and motivated people who are going to be involved in actually creating the future. So this will be founders and executives, companies, and things like this. Whoever's involved in understanding and moving things forward to make sure that those people understand. Everybody that needs to understand should understand. But that's a side project. So that won't be my primary thing. Kosian will be a different thing, but you can definitely expect that a lot of what I do through Kosian will be based on the stuff that I'm talking about with Craig.
Okay. I mean, that it's exciting. So, and I should say too, total segue and me being a nerdy fan, I really love the Theory of Bitcoin series. Like, as someone who's also studied Bitcoin and now full time for quite some time, I'm blown away that I can sit down for an hour and learn like 90% of my time. I'm learning things that I've never heard before. So thank you for doing that, by the way. It's really good content.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you to Craig as well. It's kind of like it's good that it worked out the way that it did, that we're able to keep doing this consistently and keep putting out hopefully helpful information for people. So
yeah, no, for sure. Let's cut to a question from Thrills saying, how do we provide incentive for developers to build on BSV when there's tons of speculator money building on ETH? This is actually probably the biggest single issue, but he's saying developers get millions of dollars for just non-working prototypes and BSV doesn't have that kind of funding.
Look, the answer to this, first of all, forget about raising money completely. I mean, the best thing you can do is create a business where you're creating a product or a service for people and you earn money from it. It's so obvious and simple, but that just means create a real business. And the sooner you get something that someone is willing to pay for, the better. So if you do it that way, your incentive is you're completely in charge of your own life. Create a new business where you are working directly with your customers. You're solving their problem. They're paying you money. You're in control of your business. You don't need to raise money. You don't need to sit back and have $1 million flow in. I know that's happening right now in the cryptocurrency world, but that's because these people have no idea what they're doing. This is a massive, massive bubble is what's going on. This will end. So imagine you raise $1 million to build something on Ethereum. You build something that has no long-term value and you spend 5 years of your life building it. And then 5 years, it's over because the bubble pops. Everything you built is useless because you did everything the wrong way. It's illegal and it doesn't work technically. What did you just spend the 5 years of your life working on? Well, don't be like that. If you do that on Ethereum, yeah, you get money, but there's a really big cost, which is it really won't work ultimately long term. So it's all fake right now. It's a hypey bubble based on people reading Twitter, having no idea about how any of this stuff really works. I'm not trying to just make fun of people who read Twitter, but it's really true that there's a lot of fake information on Twitter and people get their information from bad sources. They waste time and effort. So don't be jealous of people that raise money to build something on Ethereum. They are screwed. So be fortunate, be thankful that you're not screwed by being locked into building, by wasting 5 years of your life to do something that will ultimately be pointless. Instead, concentrate on how can you start earning money right away to build products and services for people. It can be on Bitcoin or it can be related or whatever your interests are. But anyway, do it that way and don't worry about raising money. This is a really common mistake, especially in the cryptocurrency world in Silicon Valley. If you raise money for bad reasons, it's bad. Like it's not going to help you ultimately. There's only one appropriate time to raise money. That is when you have a product that is already working and you need to buy $30 million worth of ads on Facebook. If it's already working and you just dump the venture capital directly into ads on Facebook and you make it grow faster, that is how you use venture capital. Anything less than that is just worse. So if you raise money because you can, it's actually a very bad reason. That's exactly what I did in 2017. And well, it didn't actually ultimately help. I mean, it was like it was a distortion of events is kind of what happened. We didn't ultimately end up any better. I think I may actually be worse off ultimately having raised money. Had I done things better and concentrated on earning money back then, everything I did, we would have fewer issues and more success, I am pretty sure, had I done it that way. And that's what I'll be doing moving forward so people can watch that. But, yeah.
That's actually a really insightful and humble way to put it, Ryan. So I appreciate hearing it from you, because I think a lot of people see you as this figurehead in, at the time, Bitcoin Cash and now on Bitcoin SV. Was it venture capital for yours.org or was it?
Where to begin? So I, we had two rounds. Yeah, it was Yours Inc. is again the name of the corporation, yeah. Right? So Yours Inc. Mm-hmm. would create Money Button. But we raised money twice. We raised money in 2016. We raised $177,500 in 2016, led by DCG. DCG put in $75,000 and like a little more than $100,000 from a long tail of other investors. We then raised another round in 2017, $1.5 million. Bitmain put in $1 million. Inchain put in $500,000. And there were like three other investors that put in $25,000 each. So it was a little more than $1.5 million. The reason why we raised that round was Bitmain came to us and gave us a good deal. Now, to anybody that knows anything about what happened, who is Bitmain? I raised money from Bitmain. Are you kidding me? What would later happen? I'm not so sure that was actually ultimately for the better. It put me in a bit of a bind over time that was not so easy to get out of. And having the company acquired was ultimately the only way I got out of the bind. So is that really better? Was I better off having raised $1.5 million? I did use the money on stuff. I mean, the initial version of Money Button, when we launched, we had like nine people working on Money Button. And for financial reasons, this dropped down to four. So we had a bunch of people working on it that I basically had to end contracts with to stop working on in 2018 because we didn't have enough money. So having, even though we raised all that money, we spent a lot, but we also had cryptocurrency, which was ruined in 2018. And so all that money went to practically nothing. We lost several million dollars. It sounds ridiculous, but that's what happened. Several million dollars worth of cryptocurrency went to being worth like $100,000 or something like that. So it's like, sure. Nearly decimated the cryptocurrency holdings of the company. So anyway, am I better off? It's unclear. I'll say that I here are two lessons that I'm going to change things so people can know. And I'm being transparent about this because I think it'll be helpful to other entrepreneurs. It really isn't some panacea to raise money. It creates all sorts of weird issues. You're beholden partially to your investors. It depends on who you raise money from. I'm only going to raise money the correct way, which is when I'm ready to dump $30 million into Facebook ads. And I'm going to bootstrap from here until there. So you'll see the stuff that I launch, I'm going to be earning small amounts of money soon. It's going to seem really small. It's like, really? That's it, Ryan? That's Kosian? You launching this? And I'm earning like $100 or something like this. But I'll earn something and I'll grow that over time. And so people, that's my strategy. Who knows whether this will work or not, but I'm going to do things differently. I'm not going to run out there and raise money. I will only raise money when I'm ready to buy $30 million of Facebook ads and not before that, because it just creates problems. So if I can bootstrap from here to there, that's by far the best option. I would recommend that to everyone.
Bootstrap. That's really good advice, Ryan. I think that's, in fact, I know people make clips of the show. I would hope that people would make a clip of that, because I think that's just excellent business advice. This applies to anybody, frankly. You don't want people in your pocket just to try to get your project out, because by the time your project gets out, and it's what it sounds like you're saying happened, is by the time you were ready to rock and roll, all kinds of problems you couldn't have predicted are then along the way, from being successful.
We don't have enough. Well, I think we're over now, but the amount of problems, it was like continuous problems. It's like stuff you can never expect. So the more you stay in control, the more you can navigate those problems when they occur. The more you hand off to other people, if those other people diverge from you, which is exactly what happened, well, they become more of a liability than an asset. These are very important issues.
Well, if you're not in a hurry to go, I would love to keep going through some of these questions. By all means, if you need
Sure. I'm not in a hurry. If you want to keep asking questions, why don't we just keep going? Yeah.
Please. Yeah. So, Alex, if you got more of the questions queued up, that'd be great. Do you have a flagship thing coming from Kosian right now, or are you willing to reveal anything at this point? Or
I give you a bit of information about that. So I'll give you two ideas. So I wrote down a list of, I've got like 10 or more product ideas. Mm-hmm. So as I said before, my real goal is I'm going to serve as Silicon Valley. So the most important thing ultimately is going to be infrastructure. So this means things like, how do you imagine actually seriously replacing the TCP layer of the internet with Bitcoin. Well, that's not something you just do one day, right? This is something where you got to build the infrastructure, but you got to have real world products and services built on top of the stuff. And I looked at that. I have a, you know, several year, ultimately this is like, I don't plan to resign ever. Like this will be, you know, this will be factored into my world mission. My mission is a bit bigger than Bitcoin. Isn't the only thing I'm interested in, but I'm happy to work on Bitcoin for a long time because I can see enormous value coming from all this stuff. So anyway, that's my market. And I want to say that, okay, well, as soon as I started trying to figure out the stuff I'm going to build, I'm going to have to make sure certain things exist beforehand. So you can rest assured, I will be involved in the creation of SPV on Bitcoin. No one has gotten SPV going on Bitcoin. I don't have a choice but to help get this going because I'm going to use SPV and all this stuff. No wallet does SPV correctly, to my knowledge anyway, at the present moment. Maybe somebody's got some proof of concepts there, but let me sketch out what this has to be. And I'll probably put this into an article. So one of the things you'll see is I'll start to write up some content because I need to write these ideas and start coordinating people, not in my company, but in others, just to coordinate on these things. So in order to get proper SPV going, you have to have several components. First of all, Kurt, again, as we said at the start of this interview series, if I'm paying you, I need to give you a transaction. That's how it's supposed to work. That's actually how the original software worked by default. The default way to pay somebody was you type in their IP address and you query them. They give you back a public key and then you send the transaction to them. That is how it really is supposed to work. And you can build SPV using that model. For various reasons, we're not going to send to an IP address. It's hard to authenticate that. It's not authenticated or private by default. We'll use Paymail. Paymail solves a number of problems. Paymail is essentially a naming and query system that is human readable and, you know, machine queryable. Express it however you want to. If you base things on Paymail, you solve an important part of the problem that can't just be solved on Bitcoin. It's solving the problem before things hit the blockchain. Okay, so it's this upfront communication stuff that has to occur. So you have Kurt at moneybutton.com or whatever. I don't know if you own that one, but maybe somebody
that
else.
That is actually it. So if anybody wants to test it out,
Perfect. Okay, we can test and give Kurt at moneybutton a payment here to make this work. So extending, so again, moneybutton and Handcash already got part of that going. We've got the transaction going. We need a few other things. We need essentially standardized BIP 270. This is the notion of a invoicing system where I don't just give you money out of the blue. I give you money because I owe you something. Almost always that's how it works. The idea of giving money to someone out of the blue, you shouldn't even accept that because who is this? Who gave you money out of the blue? What the hell is this? If it's a criminal, you don't even want it at all. So anyway, it should be more invoice based. So we need to beef up BIP 270. We need to beef up the peer-to-peer transaction protocol. We need to be able to send multiple transactions by default. In fact, the way that wallets should operate by default is I should not merge UTXOs. And I've discussed this with Craig several times on the interview series. The way it should work by default is if I pay you and I have 10 UTXOs, I give you 10 different transactions because that's what maintains privacy by default. Never reuse addresses. Never merge transactions unless you want to. There are reasons to merge them. So you can create consolidation transactions. So if you have a ludicrously large number of small outputs for whatever reason, you're accepting micropayments for a service, you'll want to consolidate them from time to time. Otherwise, the volume is just ridiculous. Like you'll give so many transactions to to deposit into a bank or whatever it is that you're doing. It gets unwieldy. So there'll be reasons to merge them. But that's the exception, not the rule. You should actually keep them unmerged by default. That's a new paradigm for how Bitcoin wallets work. The final piece in the puzzle is we need to send around the Merkle proofs. The miners need to produce Merkle proofs, give them back using the merchant API, and then we need to send them around when you send around wallets. That allows you to do offline transaction validation. So you can have an offline SPV wallet. I can give it to you. You're not even in touch with miners right now because we're on the London Underground or something like this, and there is no internet down there. But I can still buy a newspaper from you by giving you a valid transaction, which you can validate. You just can't know whether it was double spent or not. But you can know it was validated in every other way. And if you want to, you can even know who I am and things like this. You can select KYC information. When you come back online, you can confirm that it was not double spent, but you can know it was valid before contacting miners. So you can have a really quite functional, predominantly offline SPV ecosystem going with these ideas. So let me run down the ideas that have to happen. So I'm going to make sure these happen just one way or another. So peer-to-peer transactions, not merging UTXOs by default, sending multiple transactions in a single send, and then sending around the Merkle proofs with those. Those are the foundations of SPV. So I'll be creating tooling on Bitcoin that does exactly this stuff for my own ulterior motives. So my intention is not to focus on SPV wallets, but I need to create that because all the other stuff I'm going to do will require that. So to give you a flavor for what that will be, as I mentioned in the last interview series with Craig, I have an idea for a distributed fourth interpreter. This would be something where multiple different people are involved in essentially writing programs that are on as many different Bitcoin transactions as necessary. So like multi-party distributed fourth interpreter. The reason to do that is it's kind of interesting and cool, and I'd like to see it working, and it will force me to understand everything. But I could also imagine this being underneath a lot of products. It would be essentially a usability layer underneath more advanced products. When I think about the other products that I want to create on Bitcoin, and I could throw out a bunch of ideas, like, you know, one of them that I won't create, but that I know that's being created is Blair by I can't remember his name right now.
Shem
and yeah, his co-founder making Blair. You know, there's a lot of reasons to do things like this for the music world. You want to be able to essentially create track IP, deal with contracts and stuff like that. All that stuff that's true for music is also true for video, is true for countless other things. The underlying infrastructure is the same. And I can imagine a way in which a distributed fourth interpreter could be used to simplify the way that you create and standardize many of these systems. So anyway, that's an idea there. On top of that will be things like the music idea or the video idea, whatever. I've got my own ideas that are whatever. I don't know which one I'll end up doing, but the goal will be along the way, I'll be producing this infrastructure that will be useful to Silicon Valley and whoever else. Sure. So that's not a very clear answer, but that's what I'm doing.
No, there's a lot of value in there. In fact, I have a follow-up question. We talked a little bit about some of these JavaScript-based virtual machines. And I see a little debate happening in the chat here about Paymail. I think some people have had questions about Paymail adding a second layer of trust or something like that.
Look, everybody understands. But let me just answer before you can. If I get the question wrong, ask it again. But I can see what they're probably saying because I'm not reading the chat there. But
yep,
Paymail is not centralized. This is a ridiculous idea. Own your own domain name. Okay, just buy your own domain name. You can host your own Paymail server. You don't have to rely on @moneybutton.com or @handcash.io or whatever. You can do it yourself. Now, most people don't, for the same reason that most people rely on a Gmail email address. But email is decentralized in exactly the same way that Paymail is. You can buy your own domain name. You can host it yourself. You can do everything yourself. It is not centralized. Saying it's centralized is absurd. What is semi-centralized is DNS itself, the naming system. And so a lot of people criticize Paymail because they don't like DNS. But DNS has nothing to do with Paymail. We're just using DNS because it already exists. If you want to decentralize DNS, great, make decentralized DNS. I think you'll find that doing that in practice is very hard, but it can be done in principle. Sure. There are ways to essentially improve DNS. But DNS is already widely deployed globally. Everybody uses it. Google.com. That is Google. Google.com. Right. That's their primary domain name. Every company uses this. Everybody's got a domain name as their primary technical entry point. Okay. Google's primary entry point is google.com. And everybody's got one of these. It's already global. And there are issues with it, but the way to think about it is don't just upturn the entire thing and start from scratch because that will never work. People have tried this several times. You're fighting an unbelievable network effect behind DNS. So the way to do that is, again, it's like fighting a behemoth. Like you're like this small figure and there's like a dragon that is 1 million times larger than you are. If you just go poke the dragon with your sword, you're not going to win. It'll just step on you and you'll die, right?
Yeah.
So the way you do is treat DNS as a customer. How can you iterate DNS forward to a better future? That is a realistic way to do it. You can start taking steps forward. So if that's something you care about, you can concentrate on that problem specifically. But anyway, in conclusion, Paymail is not centralized. It's ridiculous. Just own your own domain name. And, you know, what more can I say?
Sure. Well, I think that's actually the beauty of it. If you own Coca-Cola.com and you want, you know, executives to be able to be emailed or paid at the same address, then, you know, spin that up. I don't think that the average person is going to create, you know, I'm not going to create Kurt.com because I'm just a person. But if I had a brand that was valuable, then by all means, they should be powered by Paymail. Yeah. At least that's the way I see it.
I mean, so some people do that, but some people don't. Yeah, even as an individual, you can do things like that, and some people do, but most people don't. Most people will just create a Facebook profile, or they'll use some other third-party service, and that's fine.
Right.
But Paymail does not lock you into that. Paymail, you know, allows you to operate it yourself completely if you want to, and you don't. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing centralized about that.
Yeah, for sure. Gonna snag another question for me, Alex? Pick a good one. No pressure. Yeah, this guy. Bitcoin is great, but how do we defeat the oligarchy that buys everything and locks it up? Is BSV part of the oligarchs? I think I would guess this has something to do with essentially like patenting all the technology and then hiding it, like I was saying about, you know, MasterCard or whatever. Is there, how much risk is there, frankly?
I mean, you are completely in charge of your own, you should be anyway, in charge of your own life here. Like, that problem is not a real problem if you just take initiative in your own life and do things. There'll be people that do something annoying to you. So perhaps it turns out that there's some evil company somewhere that's got a patent on part of the thing that you're doing and you're annoyed by it. Okay, but that shouldn't stop you. I mean, like, you're annoyed that MasterCard has a patent. You're like, fucking MasterCard. Now I got to pay license fees to MasterCard. But if the idea of paying licensing fees to MasterCard stops you from doing your business, that's not MasterCard's fault. That's like, right, someone, yeah, they're looking for excuses to give up and not do things. So if you're looking to MasterCard as they own the patent and then you just give up and quit, well, that's not on MasterCard. That's just weakness.
Right. Absolutely. Here's a good one from Ole Andre. I'm going to say Knutley. Ryan, you said you want transactions to be more invoice-based as a general rule. That sounds like a step backward. Imagine people having to go through every payment in their bank account. Feedback.
The invoices are peer-to-peer, Ole. The invoices are peer-to-peer. If I'm paying Kurt, Kurt is the one giving me an invoice. There's no bank there. It's just, if I'm paying Kurt, I'm selling you a newspaper. It's 25 cents. And I just say, here, have 24 cents. What the hell is that? Kurt needs to give me an invoice and tell me exactly how much money I owe him so I can give him 25 cents, which is what he's asking for. So that's all invoices mean. But it had nothing to do with banks. It just has to do with, it's already happening anyway. If I'm giving Kurt money, it's probably because he asked for it. It's probably not just randomly out of the blue. So it's just about creating standardized protocols for how those invoices work, and banks have nothing to do with it.
And BIP270, as I understand it, allows that function to make a payment request as well.
Yeah, it's built into BIP270. And essentially it's sort of fine. It's more like we haven't been very good at standards in the BSV world yet. So this is kind of an ongoing process. So the technical standards committee is working on this, but anyway, the only issue is that it isn't really, not enough people are doing it yet. There are other issues, like it's only one transaction by default, which I think was a mistake when we wrote up the spec for BIP270. Should have been multi. I now understand that. I didn't appreciate that enough at the time, but that can be resolved. We can extend BIP270 to support multiple transactions. So it's not really an issue. It just means we need to get around to it, do it, really standardize stuff, and be professional about that stuff.
Yeah. That should be easy, right? So we got Reserved Name Bear saying, how does a total beginner contribute to the BSV ecosystem in a way that makes income ASAP? Quickest route to income from zero. I think it's actually a smart question because, you know, you mentioned bootstrapping. If you don't, you know, if you're working a job and things, you need to find a way to make that segue. What do you think, Ryan?
Okay. Well, first of all, if you're going to be a successful entrepreneur, you have to know something and be uniquely competent at something that something somebody else doesn't have. So for instance, if your idea to start a new business is to make something that is the same as Coca-Cola, but tastes 10% better or something like this, you're fighting a behemoth. You're probably just going to lose. Like, if you're just making something 10% better than Coca-Cola, I mean, that's not much of a unique contribution. If you have something that's 10 times better than Coca-Cola, you've got a whole other story there. It's sort of adequately good enough that you can charge enough money, get going, whatever the situation is. So my answer to that is something like, you need to employ common business considerations as the template for what you do, but there has to be something that only you uniquely know about and can do. And only you can know what that is. Like, you have to identify, here's your passion, here's your skill, how do I combine this and produce value for people? And do exactly that. And no one else can tell you that. In fact, it'll probably be the opposite. Whatever that is for you, if it's actually unique to you, people are probably going to tell you you're an idiot and you're doing everything wrong because they don't know what you're actually thinking. You're only going to be able to shallow communicate what that is to other people. They're going to be like, oh, you're an idiot. You have nothing. But you have to identify what that is yourself and be willing to do that yourself. So there's no way to completely answer that question. I can only say start a real business which creates products and services for people and is actually valuable and they're willing to pay you money for it. Aside from that, what that is exactly can only be something that each individual must figure out for themselves.
Yep. No, it's a real struggle. I often say if everybody thinks it sounds like a good idea, then there's probably not an opportunity there anymore either. So We've got Demir asking, I want to build on top of Bitcoin SV, but I'm not sure where to find developers to team up with for my ideas. I can think of a few places people could go. In fact, I've talked about even telling people, hey, you can just contact me and I can hook you up with the right people. But do we have a good development resource? I think Bitcoin Association just put up a jobs board, but maybe you know things I don't, Ryan.
I can just, I'll just name some that you probably know of as well, but I'll just name them. So one way is what you just said, the jobs board. So that's a way. There are three Slack groups I can think of that I would recommend going in there. Metanet.icu, number one. Number two is Unriders Atlantis. I think that one's still active. I haven't logged into that one for a while, but there are developers there. And then the other one is a Chao Wei's S-Crypt Slack. In all of these, you'll find some developers. But as I say to anyone who's got an idea and they just need a developer to program the thing, you're going to have a tough time convincing a developer that can do it if that's your pitch, basically. Like the most important, even if you're not technical, it's a very, very good idea to try to make some initiative to create the thing yourself. You're going to have a far better idea about what it is the developer is going to need to do. You may not be a full-time developer yourself, but dive into the technical side, because if you're entirely non-technical and you're just trying to find a developer to help you build it, no developer is going to be interested in that. It'd be like, I don't even know what it is that you're saying. Like the only way you'll do that is you're just going to have to pay them a real salary. Like will be what you'll end up having to do. And even then they might not like you very much unless you can be very clear about what it is that you actually want. And that's why, like, if you need a developer, the more technical skill you can build for yourself, the better. Even if you end up hiring a developer, you should still do it that way.
For sure. That's another really good chunk of good advice. Actually, I'll give a shout out. My friend Matt Zitsky runs a group called It's a Draft, which is beginner friendly, like learn the basics of JavaScript, Python, C, and the rest of it. Just so you can speak the language. You can obviously learn to, you know, become a developer yourself, but that's a good spot to hop in and, you know, spend 3 weeks, learn the terminology, learn what, you know, the basic realms of function are for some of these things. Another question here from Don Fredrickson. When will we see the work in EDI, which seems to be a big part of the enterprise killer app? Sounds like there's a good answer for this one, Ryan.
Well, my immediate answer is, what do you mean, when will we see the work? I mean, when is Don Fredrickson going to create EDI? If Don Fredrickson wants to see EDI, how come he hasn't already created it? I mean, there's this weird, I've seen this in so many people where they say, how come no one's done this yet? What do you mean? Why aren't you doing it? Like, well, why do you expect someone else is going to go out there and do this? There's only, I'm working full-time. Greg is working full-time. You know, we're already doing things. So who is this guy? And why doesn't this guy go out there and create EDI if it's such a great opportunity? So there's more opportunities that we can handle. So it's not on just some other person to go out there and do it. EDI is enormous. There is no joke about the value of EDI. It's a $1 trillion market. It's a many, many trillions. It's used for Swift. It's used for whatever. It's used for all sorts of businesses. It's an enormous market. It's a real opportunity for someone to create a real business. There can be many probably $1 billion companies and fundamentally the same space there that don't yet exist. So it should be on that guy. Go out there and do that yourself. Don't wait for somebody else.
Well, it's funny. I keep saying this too. I think people think I'm kidding, but business development, sales, job management, onboarding, customer service, like these are things that software developers may not be the best at. But if you can create a business opportunity, we have plenty of software developers. We need people to go out there and generate business. Go do the hard legwork. Bring, you know, a good developer will see a good opportunity and say, hey, maybe you don't need to pay me for 6 months. Give me some equity in this great idea. And there you go. You have a business. So it's funny. It sounds easy, or it sounds simple, but isn't easy, I think is probably the best way to put it. We got a question here from Randy Eitzman. Ryan, are you on Twitch? If not, why?
Okay. So I was on Twitch. I have a user account on there. I'm not an active user of Twitch. To be completely blunt, and I'll say this as someone that's not working a part of Moneybutt anymore, I don't like those guys very much. They obviously have different values than I have. So I'll say that, let's see, how can I put this in a public facing way? The CEO, his name is, I can't remember his name right now. The frog guy. He's adopted as a strategy. Elon Moist. He's adopted as a strategy making false and absurd statements on social media. He is a part of the problem. He is a part of the problem that we can solve with Bitcoin. So I'm not going to have anything to do with those guys because they're using exactly the same they're using the worst tactics that that are the problem with Silicon Valley, actually. They're using the same tactics that the cryptocurrency scammers use to scam people. They're using those same tactics to draw in users. So I don't share values with those guys. I don't want to have anything to do with those tactics. If they're making false statements or absurd, overhyped crap on social media, that is the opposite of what I stand for. So I will not use Twitch for that reason.
And there you have it, everybody. It's probably going to be another one that gets cut up into a good sound sound bite for the world. But honestly, I respect you being really straightforward, really blunt. I think a lot of people are afraid to put their opinion out there because we're a community or whatever. But no, I think that's obviously a thing that anybody could work to. I mean, they should want your business. And if they don't, then you shouldn't be doing business together. I don't think it needs to be any more than that, frankly. So I guess to segue here, because my voice is going to go out, I'm sure you probably could use a bathroom break and stuff yourself. Anybody that deserves a shout out? Do you want to say hi to anybody? Do you want to do any, any hints?
Well, only to say, because I quit Fabric very quickly. I mean, a shout out to the Money Button team and the Fabric team who are doing a great job with, they're going to bootstrap the token ecosystem here. So, I'm not involved in Money Button anymore, but the team is still going strong and everything is working better now than ever before. It's been improved in countless ways. So a lot of the infrastructure is a lot better. A lot of the stuff isn't being seen on the outside. Of course, it also supports tokens now. So Money Button team, Fabric team, take a look at what they're doing and see if you want to work with them in some respect using Money Button or spooling up tokens or whatever it is that you want to do.
Yeah. So just for me personally, I'll do the professional Coin Geek live stream thing, but I just want to say as an individual, as Kurt, you really helped me on my journey. A lot of the content that you've made over the last 3-4 years now, video content, your writing really helped me sort of parse out exactly why Bitcoin, why big block Bitcoin, and why some of these other things. So yeah, I'm grateful to you in no small part. It's your bits of advice here and there that have brought me to being in the position I am. So I'm really honored to have you here. I'm honored to share this 90 minutes with you. So thank you, Ryan. And then officially the Coin Geek thing, check out Ryan X Charles, everywhere in the universe and, really keep your eye on Ryan. Ryan has a tendency to be ahead of the game in more ways than one. And, really thank you for this interview. I mean, you've given us a lot of good nuggets of information here and, I think it's really good. So, I'll let you go.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Kurt. Take that as a compliment. I appreciate the kind words and great to talk with you. And I'll see you around. And thank you very much.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ryan. So, everybody, that's it. That's the Coin Geek live stream. Just to run down, I want everybody to realize again, and Ryan, I think, expressed this really, really clearly, that there is an incalculable amount of opportunity in Bitcoin. You've got to go pursue that opportunity. Guys like Ryan or guys like Craig or any of the number, there's 5 or 6 people that everybody are asking, why aren't these things happening? Why aren't they doing more? And the people that always get mentioned are the people that I know for a fact are working 12-hour days and trying to make big business deals happen. But everybody really has their role. And I'm not kidding when I say that business development, sales, customer service, even just something as simple as putting out your own jobs board website or building some of these businesses, these are the opportunities for you. So every time you see a weakness in Bitcoin or you look at, hey, why isn't anybody doing this thing that's super valuable? That's your business opportunity. And you may not be the best person to get that job done, but you could be the person that coordinates the team and there are big opportunities there, but you have to first believe in yourself and you have to take those opportunities or you take those challenges and realize that those are the opportunities and that, being an investor in Bitcoin doesn't really confer upon you any special rights or privileges other than just I mean, you own a little bit of space on the ledger, and that's cool, but it's not nearly as cool as changing the world with a really big idea that can only be solved with Bitcoin. And so I'll say it again, as I've said a few times, if you have a really good idea and you're not sure where to start, feel free to DM me. My DMs keep getting harder and harder to get through as they keep spilling in. But this is what gives me hope about Bitcoin SV really changing the world, is I've had dozens of people come to me with really good ideas, and I'm starting to connect some of those people to the right developers and business partners to get these things done. So I think over time, that work, that sweat equity that you put into Bitcoin, that can end up being generational wealth for you and your family, but it can also really change the world for the entire economy. And that's what we're here to do. We're here to solve problems of payment friction and data integrity across the entire economy. And then we all benefit. The spillover benefits are incalculable, but you have to start by realizing that you as an individual are powerful enough to pursue these things. So please tell your friends to watch the CoinGeek Weekly live stream every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we will have excellent guests. And sometimes you will just be the guest, and it will be me, Kurt Wooker Jr., answering your questions as best I can with the help of my lovely executive producer, Alex Moon, who I see grinning in his chair. Again, just share, like, subscribe, tell your friends that this is a safe place for them to come ask questions about Bitcoin or anything else. I will talk about the rest of the cryptocurrency economy and explain all the risks and everything else there too. But I'm Kurt Wooker Jr. Thanks again. See you next week.
This is buybsv.com, the quick and simple way to buy Bitcoin SV. You can't miss it. It says a quick and simple way to buy BSV on buybsv.com. It's safe and secure. Within an hour, you'll own BSV digital assets, which means it's so quick and simple. So if you want to buy BSV, use buybsv.com. It does exactly what it says.